Hi, I'm Paul Ingalls. Around Thanksgiving, 1968, I was 12 years old and among the millions who ran out to buy an extraordinary new collection of songs from the Beatles. John Lennon, Paul McCartney, George Harrison, and Ringo Starr. Since Sgt. Pepper's Lonely Hearts Club Band in June of 1967, there hadn't been a full album of new Beatles material. Magical Mystery Tour and Yellow Submarine both mixed a few new tunes with previously released singles and B-sides. But now, a double album of 30 new songs in an era when dull albums really weren't often done. And in contrast to the psychedelic covers of their previous three albums, this album jacket was all white. The words "The Beatles" were embossed in an angle in small print on the cover. The music inside was frankly a bizarre but stimulating mix, and I remember feeling after a first listen in the wood-paneled basement of my family's home in suburban Maryland that this wasn't an album we could play on the family stereo upstairs, because it sounded, a lot of it, kind of naughty, actually. I used to listen with my best friend Johnny Sedwitz. Johnny Sedwitz isn't here tonight, but, let me say that again. Johnny Sedwitz isn't here today, but I'm here with other friends, and we're going to hang out and listen to the White Album again, and remember with you what it was like to hear it for the first time. Let's go around the room and tell me your name and where you were in 68, where you were living and listening to the White Album.
My name is Travis Parkin. I was 19 years old in 1968, and I was living in upstate New York in Albany, but I actually discovered the album while visiting in Ann Arbor, Michigan.
Do you remember where you might have heard most of it?
Oh, absolutely.
So give me a sentence, like I would have been listening to it.
I was rooming with some college students from the University of Michigan near the campus, and I was listening to it in a guest room they had upstairs.
Great.
Okay, I'm Lucio Urbano, and I was 14 in 1968. I grew up in West Texas, outside of Buddy Holly Land, Lubbock, Texas. And I was a migrant worker in those days, so we couldn't afford stereos, and we couldn't afford LPs, but we heard about it. And radio at that time was being adventurous, so we got to hear some Beatles music that we could not hear on regular radio. So it was quite an experience at that time.
Good. Thanks, Lou.
I'm Scott McNichol. I was just turning 15 when the White Album came out, and I was living here in Albuquerque, New Mexico. And my distinct memory is the very first listen, all four sides straight through, with about 8 to 10 of us, about half 15-year-olds and about half 18-year-olds in my buddy's house. His older brother had bought the record, and we sat quietly for our teenagers on a Sunday afternoon and listened to all four sides straight through.
Okay.
I'm Suzanne Kreider. I was 13 in 1968. I probably heard pieces of the album on the radio, but I suspect I didn't listen to the whole album until a couple years later, probably in Bill Barrington's basement near Chamblee, Georgia.
Dear Prudence and Back in the USSR, what do you think, Beatle fan panel? Who has something to say? You can just give me like a thumbs up.
I just remember it on radio. You know, I don't remember listening to LPs and all that. So those were popular songs right away that I remember. It's the USSR, Back in the USSR. But Prudence, to me, came later in the 70s with the psychedelic, so I'm not too much aware of that time frame of the White Album.
That's okay. Cool. Travis?
Yeah, I remember hearing Back in the USSR, thinking to myself, this is pure rock and roll. This is as good as rock and roll really gets. It had all the elements of Chuck Berry and the Beach Boys, and it just made you want to get up and move. It also made me kind of think, growing up in the Eisenhower and Kennedy years with all the tensions between the USA and the USSR, we kind of were taught to feel like we had it good here and they wanted to get out of the USSR and get over here if they could. But it made me stop and think for a minute and wonder if they had a certain sense of national pride and would they miss all those things in their country if they were to come over here.
This was right in the heart of the Cold War, really. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Anybody else? Scott?
Well, it just screamed the Beach Boys right off the grooves when you first laid the needle down. Where did they pick that up? You know, of course, we didn't know the ins and outs of where they were, what they were doing, but right off the start of the record, you're on the beach and, hair flying in the breeze. And the USSR thing is so true because it was, the Better Dead Than Red thing was very much alive in America, and my parents no less. So it was like a how bold are the Beatles to use the USSR in a song? So,
and we should note Scott is wearing a Back in the USSR T-shirt.
Right.
And we didn't know at the time really how close the Beatles and the Beach Boys were watching and listening to each other's music. We've learned that since, but Suzanne?
It just made me think about the Beach Boys, and gosh, all I wanted was to know what kind of girl Paul was looking for. And so it was just so exciting to hear him talking about, the kinds of girls that he wanted.
Any thoughts about Dear Prudence? It's okay. Scott?
A beautiful plea to a woman or some girl. It's just, it just sings of this, please come out and join me, that's what it sounded as a teenager, please, I want to be with you, come out and enjoy this beautiful day in this world with me. I think that simple guitar line really sets the whole thing off. It almost sounds like an orchestra to me, the way it rings. So it's a beautiful kind of love plea.
Lou?
Everyone else remembers how bad Paul was, the bass, and so when I heard that he did acoustic on that, it's like a lot of us couldn't, how can a bass player that bad, play guitar that well too? So it was like, and then of course, Upside Down.
You mean bad as good, right?
Yes, good. Check yes, of course. These hip language.
Oobla Dee, Oobla Da, and then Glass Onion before that. Thoughts panel? Scott McNichol.
It almost seems like this is a troupe of actors, mimes, and musicians all. It's just, this thing comes out in this almost childlike romper room, if you will, ditty. And this colors of comings and goings and doings and things. I just feel these people, I see them with colorful makeup on, and they're just kind of dancing around as they sing this song.
I liked this song for a while, but I stopped liking it after about 10 years or so, and I can hardly stand to listen to it anymore. Suzanne?
Where's I Want to Hold Your Hand? It's like, what happened to the Beatles? I wasn't into the musicality of the album because I was such a young kid, but it was just scary. Like, Glass Onion, it was too much to try to figure out where they were coming from, and I just wanted the old Beatles back.
Lou?
Glass Onions in those days in the 60s in West Texas, we weren't aware of because those a little bit more on the psychedelic or more on the edge. But Oobla Dee, Oobla Da right away brings a big old smile to me because, we worked in the fields, and in those days a hoe was a garden tool that we cut weeds with, Where we dance with those hoes, we play guitars with those hoes, oobla dee, oobla da, and I just keep on remembering, working those fields. And as Americans, we were American, Mexican Americans, it was oobla dee, oobla da with those hoes and dancing with them, playing the guitar. And it's just, that was the American side of us,
I'm sure that was a great
song. It was a lot of
fond
memories of that.
For me, Glass Onion was really a confrontational song, that John was kind of confronting his fans and listeners with their rumors, and to me it showed what a conscious guy he was, because how many people would make a song about their songs and about their relationships with their fans? The other tune, Oobla Dee, Oobla Da, what struck me about it was it had this ska, really a ska rhythm section. That's what it's a rhythm arrangement. That's what it sounded like to me. And he kept making reference to this guy Desmond, and at that time I was also listening to Desmond Decker, and so I thought, sure, that's who he was talking about, but it probably wasn't.
Yeah, it definitely had a reggae feel to it, for sure. Although the person who supposedly gave the title was Nigerian, but he certainly converted it that way. It's the White Album Listening Party, and for time's sake, we're going to jump ahead on side one, down to George Harrison's While My Guitar Gently Weeps, and then John Lennon's Happiness is a Warm Gun. Steve Turner, both of these songs were born when each writer's eye was drawn to a phrase on a written page. Isn't that right? Both of these songs were born when each writer's eye was drawn to a phrase on a... Both of these songs were born when each writer's eye was drawn to a phrase on a written page. Harrison was purposely exploring the I Ching's principle of chance to inspire a song. He picked up a book and decided he'd open to a random page in a novel and write something from the first words he saw, and those words were "gently weeps," and he went with that. Now, John Lennon saw the words "happiness is a warm gun in your hand" on the cover of a gun magazine that producer George Martin had left in the studio, and he went with that phrase and turned it into this sexually charged series of images, many contributed by Neil Aspinall, Derek Taylor, and Pete Shotton, all Beatles insiders who were acid-tripping with Lennon one day when they were working on the song. The White Album, side one, ending with Happiness is a Warm Gun and While My Guitar Gently Weeps Before It. What comes to mind, Suzanne?
So much of my relationship with this album was about each of the guys. So George was the shy Beatle that every girl wanted to take care of. And you just loved his voice and loved the song. It was so powerful. But John was like the creepy Beatle, you know, who was just, there was something wrong with him. And even as a kid, I didn't know what depression was. I just knew that this guy was really depressed. And the song was just so scary. A friend of mine told me that it really wasn't about sex. It was about shooting up heroin and, oh, it was like really creepy.
Anybody else?
I think when you hear things like Happiness is a Warm Gun, you hear a little bit of back of their ripple effect coming back to them from the rest of the music world. I see with the grungy guitars and stuff where they had been so produced, and here you have Lennon with Glass Onion, and now to Happiness is a Warm Gun, more of a raw rock and roll sound, as opposed to the more produced things you'd heard recently in Magical Mystery Tour and Sgt. Pepper's.
I think George Martin even left the sessions for 3 months or something and turned it over to Chris Thomas because I guess he wasn't being called on to do very many orchestrations or some of the things he had been asked to do in the past. Anybody else? Lou, Travis, any of these songs? It's okay to pass.
Yeah, pass.
Okay. Okay, we'll flip the first of the two albums and explore side two in a moment. You're sitting in on the White Album Listening Party. I'm Paul Ingalls. More after this break. Let me redo that. When I'm talking, try not to clear your voice.
OR marks are live all the time.
Yeah.
Okay, sorry.
Yeah, he's just keeping them up so that we don't lose your track. We'll flip the first of the two albums and explore side two in a moment. You're sitting in on the White Album Listening Party. I'm Paul Ingalls. More after this break. This is the White Album Listening Party. About a dozen Beatle fans and musicians hanging out in our virtual basement here, re-experiencing the Beatles' 1968 collection of songs known as the White Album. I'm Paul Ingalls. Side two starts with a jaunty Paul McCartney tune and then a languid John Lennon tune, Martha, My Dear, Then I'm So Tired. Steve Turner is the author of A Hard Day's Right, and he's on the line with us from London. Steve, what can you tell us about these two songs? Martha was the name of Paul McCartney's English sheepdog, but most agree that this song is about the waning days of Paul's relationship with British actress Jane Asher. And I'm So Tired was probably inspired by how long the meditation sessions were in India. They were disrupting John Lennon's sleep and making him long for a drink and a smoke, which were both not allowed at the retreat. That's I'm So Tired and Martha, My Dear. Oops. That's I'm So Tired and Martha, My Dear, starting side two of the Beatles' White Album. Anybody have thoughts on these? Travis Parkin?
I think it's real apparent, and Martha, my dear, how much influence Paul had in the arrangement of that song, because after 40 years listening to it, it sounds exactly like Paul McCartney and Wings of the late 70s, which he had total artistic control of.
Just say this phrase for me, after all these years.
After all these years.
Okay. And it sounds like this might have been one that George Martin did sit in on, because you had some string arrangements there that were pretty neat. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Scott?
My first impressions as a youth listening to this, obviously it harkens right away back to when I'm 64, so I kind of picture Paul with his great aunt Martha at tea on a Sunday afternoon, and maybe she's a little, getting a little loss of mind and such, and something like that, and don't forget who you are, Martha, and don't forget who I am. But that's the way it kind of struck me, is this, very proper, very English.
It's interesting to me how we do create our own ideas about what the songs are about. There's so much study in the years hence about what the songs were about, and that kind of creeps in. But when we first heard them, we were making up our own little pictures like that. Anybody else on these two?
I feel so embarrassed at times. It's only, again, it was a period where we couldn't afford the, and I've noticed now in talking to the panel that some of us grew up in the city where it was different for those in the city, more accessible to, the music and more radio stations venturing out versus West Texas, Baptist country. And so when I listen to music now as a music programmer, at KUNM, it just brings me joy to see that the influence that I have of these new bands are coming out today, venturing out into with violins and cellos and doing something the Beatles did back then. So I'm kind of, at least feel like, I can justify what I missed out then,
They changed all the rules.
Exactly.
Yeah.
And I'm glad to see a youth catching on to it.
Thanks. Suzanne? No? Scott?
Once again, then you come from Martha, my dear, into like a slow blues again, the rawness of the way Lennon was playing. And now you have almost three Glass Onion, two Happiness is a Warm Gun, and I'm So Tired. And he's singing almost like he's in a blues stupor, and it's that kind of grinding away.
There are some really sweet mellow tunes by Lennon on here, but overall it is a really, loud, anguished voice that we're hearing most of the time through this album. Okay. Onward on side two, Blackbird from Paul and Piggies from George. Steve Turner, what can you tell us about these two? Blackbird, says Paul McCartney, has a melody based on a Bach piece that he learned as a teenager and words based on racial tensions that were running high in the summer of 1968 in America. And then Piggies from George Harrison was a poke at the English middle class. It's one of the songs that convicted murderer and cult leader Charles Manson interpreted as a message to him directly to literally attack the establishment. He murdered 8 in California in the following year and dropped clues that this song, Piggies, was in his mind in committing the crimes. Harrison, of course, was horrified when he heard that. Piggies and Blackbird, and I'll start us off by saying that Piggies sure sounded menacing to me back then. Even a song that had damn in it, as in damn good whacking, seemed illicit to a 12-year-old. Anyone else on these songs?
Piggies, to a 15-year-old and you're trying to learn the hip language, went right to the cops for me. Although this is being something different about the upper class in England and stuff, but this is what it spoke to me about the police and going along with the streets of America as they were at the time, turning red with fire and the revolution upon us. But maybe not the right subject, but that's what it told me. Piggies, cops.
That's how a lot of Americans would have heard it. They'd have made that association.
1968 was such a pivotal year in my life, because it was the year I was in the seventh grade.
Suze, could you just start that sentence again for me?
1968 was a pivotal year in my life. I was in the seventh grade, which was elementary school. Martin Luther King was assassinated, and I remember my parents didn't get real upset about it. It was almost like their reaction was sort of this really creepy blend of fear, is it going to be worse now, and sort of some relief. And I remember I was just devastated when Bobby Kennedy was assassinated. And what I learned from those two murders was that people who speak up get killed. Then that fall, I went to high school. I was in the eighth grade. And so a song like Piggies was just terrifying to me. Like the fabric of my life, and just thinking ahead to my future and what it meant, it just seemed so scary to a kid like me.
Was it scary because it sounded like somebody was talking back?
I mean, I didn't even listen to the words. It was more like what I would call satanic sounding songs on the album were just really scary. It was like they reinforced this scary world syndrome that had been created by these two important men in my life who had been murdered because they spoke up. So it didn't. It's not that any of it made any sense. It's just that the White Album just seemed to reinforce the scary world syndrome. A lot of the scary songs.
Thanks. Moving on with side two, here comes Rocky Raccoon and Don't Pass Me By, and Why Don't We Do It in the Road? Beatle author Steve Turner, what's the headline on where these songs came from? Rocky Raccoon is Paul's musical western. One story has the inspiration for the doctor who came in stinking of gin to work on the wounded Rocky in the song was actually a drunken doctor who attended not so well to a cut lip that Paul had suffered. Then Don't Pass Me By was Ringo Starr's first complete Beatles writing effort. And he wrote it in 1964, and it took him 4 years to get around to recording it. And Two Monkeys in India, copulating in full view, inspired the lovely and sweet Why Don't We Do It in the Road? Why Don't We Do It in the Road? Don't Pass Me By and Rocky Raccoon. Comments from our esteemed panel? Scott?
Okay, Rocky Raccoon, an episode of Gunsmoke, put the song. But otherwise, what it really rings in my head is Underground FM, you know, and I was just being introduced to it, and this song was the one they really seemed to pick up on, and day to day when you turned on, and just this free-form flow of rock and roll every day, this song seemed that DJ seemed to really like and hear on a real regular basis.
That's something worth mentioning, because in 1968... this album was so deep. I mean, it had so many songs, and if it were more the era of hit radio on AM that we were dependent on up until 1966, 1967, we wouldn't have heard very many of these songs. Whatever they might have picked for a single, we might have heard just a couple of tunes. But because of FM radio, the DJs who were given free rein were really digging deep and playing just about everything from start to finish. I thought it was funny to hear Paul McCartney do this sort of American hokey Western accent at the beginning. And I also remember that was a song that, as a 12-year-old, one of the stunts was to try to remember all those words. You know, somewhere in the mining hills of South Dakota, there lived a young boy named... We used to try to impress each other by seeing how far we could get into it before somebody would catch us and say, no, that's not right. Anybody else? Travis?
You know, Rocky Raccoon was... I'm sure the first song that I heard from this album, and it was the song that got airplay in my hometown in Albany, New York, and I'd been listening to that. I was very familiar with that song for probably 3 or 4 months before I actually went out and bought the album in the spring of 1969. The other thing I wanted to mention, the song Don't Pass Me By had a beautiful bluegrass fiddle was brought in on that song, and my parents were big, you know, Hank Williams, Patsy Cline people, and so as kids in our late teens, it was totally uncool to listen to country music. But when this fiddle came in, I had to kind of rethink my position, I guess I'd say.
Ringo always called it kind of a country tune, and I've never been able to find in any of my books who the musician was who played the country fiddle on it. I'm looking at one right now, and it still doesn't list it, so a great uncredited solo. Suzanne?
These three cuts really epitomize to me how I just couldn't get this album. You know, as an adult, I love it, and I really respect all the music and enjoy it. But as a kid, it was like, oh, my God, these guys are so freaked out on drugs. It's so crazy because all these songs were so different. You got, like, what, Crossover to Country, a song my grandparents would love, and then just this incredibly lascivious, you know, I've seen monkeys copulating in India, and it's just like, it was just insane to me to see, to try to put these guys, put the Beatles, okay, Hard Day's Night. Oh, my God, what happened to these guys? It was upsetting. I thought I lost them.
Okay, good. Let's see. Okay, here we go. Side two closes with two acoustic gems, I Will from Paul McCartney and Julia from John Lennon. Steve Turner, author of The Gospel According to the Beatles and other books, tells us about these two. Steve? I Will, though simple, took 67 takes in the studio, reportedly written to Paul's new girlfriend and later wife, Linda Eastman. They just started going out at that time. John's mom was named Julia. She had left John to be raised by an aunt. But by then, when John was a teen, had re-entered his life. They were becoming quite close when she was killed by a drunken bus driver in 1958. The song is also a love song to Yoko Ono, who was at John's side constantly by then, and the first two lines are borrowed from Khalil Gibran, almost word for word. There's Julia, and before that, I Will, closing out side two, record one of the Beatles' White Album. Any comments here on these two?
They almost sound as one, in a sense. Two guys expressing love for females in their lives at different points, one being maternal, one being a girlfriend. But the sound, if you as we listen to them there back to back, it almost seems like they were paired that way on purpose. They're very, very similar in my head in their pacing and the way they're played. It's very simple, very straightforward, and very pretty songs.
And we have heard from time to time about how John Lennon and Paul McCartney would compete a little bit. It's hard to know exactly when this particular sequence happened, but they might have been bookend pieces, you know. Anybody else on this? Travis?
It was the spring of 1969, and I was participating as a volunteer in a medical study on hypoglycemia in Ann Arbor, Michigan, staying in off-campus housing with some students my age, 19, 20 years of age. And it was a beautiful Saturday morning, and my temporary roommates gave me a tab of window pane that morning, and I ingested it, and probably an hour and a half, 2 hours later, I was walking through the beautiful streets, which were a little wobbly at the time, of Ann Arbor, and I heard the song, Julia, coming. It seemed like it was coming from miles away, and it was drawing me like a siren in the Greek mythological sense. It seemed like it took a week for me to get to the source of that song, and when I got to where it was coming from, it was a garage sale. One of the students, the semester was over, and one of the students was packing up, and he had all of his albums out there, and this was the album that he was playing, and that was the second Beatles song I became familiar with after Rocky Raccoon was Julia, and I just loved it, and to this day I have an affinity for the name Julia as a result.
Anybody else on these two? No? Suze? No.
I Will sounds like a Beatles song. It reminds me of the old Beatles or maybe something off of Rubber Soul, so I really love that song.
You've dropped in on the White Album Listening Party. Bunch of Beatle fans and musicians are re-experiencing the Beatles' 1968 release. In the studio with me are several DJs, past and present, and program hosts from public radio station KUNM here in Albuquerque. We have the lights down low and are listening to the record in much the way many of us did with our friends back in 1968, 69, 70. Listening to it, talking about it, trying to figure it out. Let's have you each introduce yourselves around the horn here one more time. Just names only this time.
I'm Travis Parkin.
I'm Lucio Urbano.
I'm Scott McNichol.
Suzanne Kreider.
And I'm Paul Ingalls. Officially, this album was just called The Beatles, but it was known as the White Album for its decidedly uncolorful album design. What did you guys make of this album design? All white, the words The Beatles embossed on the cover, nothing on the spine, and then a serial number stamped on the front. What did you guys think of this when you finally saw it?
Innovative. It was different. So much was coming at you at that time from so many angles of this explosion, and here they had been so explosive in colors and music in their previous releases, and suddenly here was this something different.
Yeah, because
like a slice of bread.
Right, because Sgt. Pepper, Magical Mystery Tour, Yellow Submarine couldn't have been more colorful or more psychedelic, and then this comes along.
When I first saw the White Album cover, I thought I had a promo copy in my hands, and it had been released prior to the cover art having been completed.
The design was suggested by artist Richard Hamilton, and you know, I wonder if he got credit or paid for this very simple design. What about this poster and these color 8x10 photographs of each member of the band that came into it? Got the poster up in the studios here on the other side, all the lyrics. You probably remember the photos, too. I have them someplace. What did I do with my album? But you remember them. They were these really high quality.
Right, high quality individual photos.
Key word, individual. No group photos.
Right. The end of the Beatles, damn it!
But the poster
we're losing them.
The poster itself is almost like a small history of them, of their career as popular artists. If you look all the way through, it's a little personal in points, sitting on the bed, no clothes on, to live shots, to just hanging out in the bathtub.
Linda Eastman was taking pictures at that time?
Yeah, she was in the mix. I don't know if any of these are Linda Eastman photos. That's a good question, though. Does Suzanne need to say we're losing the Beatles again? Was that over-modulated?
We can Sorry.
That's all right. Just for safety's sake, if you could pot her down a notch or two and say, we're losing the Beatles, damn it.
So I guess I was kind of leaning in a little too.
Yeah, and then
we're losing the Beatles.
Damn it.
We're losing the Beatles, damn it. It's like they're gone. Like, where's the mop tops? I just want them to cut their hair and get the matching suits on again. Ugh. It's freaking me out.
The packaging intrigued us, but the music was the main thing. And as we did last hour with record one, we're going to hear many of the tracks on record two. We also have a panel of musicians standing by with us, both here in the studio and across the country, helping us tune our ears to some specifics about the music and the lyrics. John Spurney is in New York, Christy Krueger in Dallas, Rob Martinez, Lorenzo Martinez, and Halima Christie here in New Mexico, Douglas Grant in Tucson, David Gans in Oakland, and Richard Goldman in Los Angeles. Finally, Steve Turner, author of the book A Hard Day's Right, The Stories Behind All the Beatles Songs, is online with us from London. Steve, into side three, Birthday and Your Blues, back-to-back, pack quite a wallop. Linda Eastman's birthday was coming up when Paul was working on this one, made up mostly in the studios. Paul loved it. John later sensitively called it a piece of garbage. And then John's Your Blues is a peek at what was to come in John's solo work, an early primal scream about suicidal thoughts and confusion. Okay, there's John Lennon's Your Blues and the birthday ahead of that. Panel? Oh. Lou?
No.
Right. Scott?
Well, birthday just rings out to me, and it's finally there was a song to supplant that little simple little song we sang to everybody with the candles ablaze, and I thought this was just a great leap forward for that. And it's just pure fun, and something you know, and you play it for somebody's birthday and smile.
Yeah. It was rated PG.
Anything else? Your Blues. Scott?
Yeah, once more, John, we fall into that grinding blues. I can only think that he was listening to Muddy Waters a lot then or something, but it's real tortured soul music. It's a real grind. It's grunge long before there was the term grunge.
And I think Cream was hot then and was influencing sort of the heavier sound, too.
I'm understanding Susan when she says, whatever happened to the Beatles? Because we grew up that way, too. It was so commercial here in the Southwest, you know, it's still like that. But I'm just saying that when I went to Colorado Springs and grew up there as a teen, that's when I got to experience the White Album. That's when I got to experience the Beatles being more progressive, more on the edge, and I like that, you know, because at that time in the 70s, they were part of that movement, that progressive rock movement.
I think I was listening to this album a lot, but I think that I started listening to it more religiously when I got to be 18, 19, yeah. You know, and some of the angst and the despair that was, frankly, in a lot of those John Lennon songs was you know, finally getting around to speaking to me. But the first time through, I think I was listening, but again, my main theme on this is that I was really afraid to let my parents hear this album, you know, because they kind of liked the Beatles. You know, our parents liked the Mop Tops. They didn't seem too threatening, and boy, they really were changing.
Or yeah, I can have cool parents.
Well, I can remember. Oh, sorry. Oh. Well, I can remember I was 19 or 20 wanting to skip through and just listen to the raunchy, depressing mm-hmm. songs. And just cut the other crap. It was fun to put those, just kind of slice all those together.
Yeah, I think I really flip-flopped because the McCartney stuff seemed safe and closer to, you know, the old Beatles. We were familiar with some of that stuff on Sgt. Pepper or even back to Revolver. But we were definitely getting something new out of Lennon. Mother Nature's Son and Everybody's Got Something to Hide Except Me and My Monkey are next. Steve Turner? Mother Nature's Son was born out of a lecture by the Maharishi on the unity of man and nature when the Beatles were out in India. And then John Lennon said, Everybody's Got Something to Hide Except Me and My Monkey was about all the tension that the other Beatles and everybody else in the circle was feeling because Yoko was suddenly all around. Nobody had been allowed into Beatles sessions, and Yoko Ono was at John's side all the time. Everybody seemed to be paranoid except for us two who were in the glow of love, John said years later. Mother Nature's Son and Everybody's Got Something to Hide Except Me and My Monkey, a song that I've always loved. I'm looking up here. Who was responsible for the fire bell? It says George Harrison was responsible for that. That always fascinated me with that song. Anybody else?
What's fascinating me now listening to it is George Harrison. You know, I've always, you know, of course, everyone can admire Lennon and McCartney, but George Harrison for his style of guitar playing, you know.
Yes. Yes, yeah. I mean, and this album and the albums leading up to it, he was still trying to establish his own identity, and I think John and Paul were still pushing him out. Something else? Scott?
Mother Nature's Son, we talk as born of a Maharishi lesson, but to me it speaks of Mark Twain. I think of Huck Finn, you know, walking through a sunlit forest path and skipping stones and that sort of thing, and kind of that freedom of man and nature, and just that's what it tells me, like in a folkish way.
It's the third of three really wonderful acoustic tunes that Paul McCartney put on this album, I thought. Travis?
In revisiting this entire album, it's occurred to me how much closer to my heart Disc 1 has been over the years than Disc 2. I probably listened to Disc 1 five times as much as Disc 2. That having been said, Me and My Monkey really was a harbinger of what was to come from John Lennon in later years. I mean, the angst in his voice. You know, when I listen to that song now, it almost sounds like it was something Lennon put out 10 years later.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I think in contrast to some of the other, well, the term we've been using, scarier tunes on this album, though, is that there was a little element of joy in that whole thing. You know, come on, it's such a joy. Someone, it's such a joy. You know, everybody take it easy, take it easy. I like that. Let's play the three songs that end side three now, back to back. Sexy Sadie, Helter Skelter, and Long, Long, Long. Sexy Sadie is the Maharishi Mahesh Yogi who the Beatles were into for a time, but grew suspicious of him when they heard a rumor about the Maharishi making a sexual advance toward one of the women on retreat, and Lennon wrote this song with that in mind. Helter Skelter is another name for a spiral fairground slide. The word is that Paul was inspired by The Who's kind of out-of-control style on the single that was out at the time, I Can See for Miles, and he said he wanted to produce a song that would freak people out. Long, 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 a George Harrison song that was inspired by Dylan's Sad-Eyed Lady of the Lowlands. There's Long, 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 Helter Skelter, and Sexy Sadie. Anyone? Travis.
For me, looking back, I'm hearing heavy metal in Helter Skelter. I'm hearing a precursor to the heavy metal days, and I'm not surprised that Charles Manson would, of all songs, would latch onto that.
Yeah, it is wild and loud and crazy. I mean, if Paul was trying to create a song that would freak people out, it is a freak out. Scott?
This song really spoke to me of heroin for some reason. The up and the down and come back to love you again. And it cresting with the peak and then coming down and that grind and coming back to find it again. That's what it's, you know, although it says it's not about that for all this time, I've always thought it was simply a drug addiction reference.
Hmm. Anybody else? Any of those tunes? Suzanne?
Lock up your daughters. That song freaked me out, man. I'm like, okay, take all your Beatles albums and burn them, man. Well, these guys are over the edge. They're gone.
Once
it's so sad.
Once you get the backwash, because here at this point in their career, they weren't quite the only ones on Mount Olympus anymore in the rock and roll world. You had they were alongside Cream, Hendrix, the Stones, certainly. And the whole Bay Area scene, L.A., everybody had really the Doors. So it was coming back on them, too, and they wanted to play some rock and roll and do some different things.
Yeah, well, this is a great point, because the whole scene was about pushing the envelope and doing stuff that wasn't safe. So they were right in step, in a way, in retrospect, weren't they?
You bet. You know, they wanted to grind out the heavy guitars all the way down to the... to the acoustic stuff that, you know, they heard, which is certainly, when you come out of the Bay Area, and we know that they were real close to the Birds and stuff, who could go, you know, you go folk 1 minute to giant wah-wahs the next, and feedback and what have you. Everybody was employing everything they could.
Yeah, and they made reference to McCartney listening to The Who with Keith Moon, the wildest drummer in history, and Pete Townsend breaking guitars and slashing and burning, right on par with Hendrix. So, yeah, they were trying to keep up in a bit. I mean, we think of the Beatles as leaders, and they were because they had this incredible platform that everybody would be listening so closely.
That's why I don't get why they did such a, you know, wide range of different genres of music in this one album. To me, it was like some kind of, like, you know, bipolar Beatles personality. I just didn't get it. Were they trying to sell albums for everybody, or were they just making fun of us, or they didn't have the guts to just do some really heavy album? I don't get it.
Ooh, no, I don't see it like that at all. I see it that these guys were growing. You know, they're still young, and they're, you know, look at the way the bass line that Paul comes up with. You know, not just George, but those bass lines. And just taking the different genres, different styles, this is what, you know, freeform for us today is. You know, is alternative rock of today. I hadn't realized until now, how the reflection. I don't know if these kids are listening, or they should actually be listening to this White Album, you know?
Yeah, I talked with record producer John Leventhal about the Revolver album, and he talked about the Beatles being so eclectic. It kind of started there, you know, because the personalities were emerging. Paul was doing his sort of sweet thing, and then he was doing his music hall thing, and that obviously played all the way through all of those albums in 66, 67, 68, certainly on this one too. And then Lennon is tripping out. I mean, he's literally tripping out and getting into a deep philosophy, but also exploring a real deep pain of his own. And then Harrison's finally getting hurt a little bit, and Ringo's keeping the beat.
You have maturing personalities and a lot of internal chemical reactions going on too, which certainly, even in marriages, separates marriages, alcoholism, drug addiction. It was no different for these guys. They were really close-knit for a very long time. Just literally 8 hours on stage a night in Hamburg once upon a time, and now they were probably a little tired of one another at some point here.
I would compare it to sex as far as just keeping it interesting as far as, the music, why they didn't stay still with just the harmonic and love songs and, just make it interesting, So that's the way I look at it.
Sometimes when I think of the Beatles, I think of them as the different components of a single human being, and I think of Paul McCartney as the head, as the thinker, as the person who makes sure the music remains just commercial enough so that it'll sell. And I think of John Lennon as really being the heart of the band. And I perceive George Harrison as being the spirit or the soul of the Beatles. And Ringo, like you say, he was keeping the beat. He was kind of like every man. He was a person in the band that we could relate to that was not quite as godlike as the others. Mm-hmm. He was more like us.
Was he like the muscles?
Maybe so, yeah. He was the physical body of the band,
will.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
This is the White Album Listening Party. About a dozen Beatle fans and musicians hanging out in our virtual basement here, re-experiencing the Beatles' 1968 collection of songs known as the White Album. I'm Paul Ingalls. Side 4 starts off with Revolution Number 1, which was unusual right off the bat because all of us had heard Revolution, the raucous version of the same song released as a single some months before. Then there's this sort of loping version of it on this record, which was kind of surprising to me anyway.
Well, between the two, the first one, when you're young, the single just kicked your ass. It was raucous. It was, if you want to compare it to the song, it was like The Who. It was in your face. It was
purposefully distorted.
That was music for me back then. I need, 90 miles an hour. That's why I wanted my rock and roll, 24/7. And when the version came out on a White Album, it was like, what did they do to this? It was different, but it was okay. But once again, I think Lennon was tending more to go, for lack of better anything, it's toward Chicago again, once toward the we're slowing down to the blues again.
Okay, you mentioned Chicago. I was just about to mention Chicago as a context for this song. It's just, this is 1968, Democratic National Convention, riots in the streets. For the Beatles to be writing a revolution song, say you want a revolution, yes, no, I'm in, I'm out. Paul McCartney didn't want this song to come out because he just thought it was too controversial.
Well, I think Lennon was calling a lot of kids in the streets bluff, where they were out there just, letting the hormones fly rather than really being out there for the revolution,
He's asking them, are you in, are you out?
Right.
Are you really up for this?
Yeah. Are you toting that picture of Chairman Mao because you really believe in that, or is it just a cool thing to do?
And the dissension within the group is really apparent in this song as well. Given John and Paul's inability to agree on whether they were in or out on the destruction, the band sings, "If you talk about destruction, don't you know that you can count me out?" And then a second later, Paul chimes in.
Yeah, I heard John Lennon interviewed about that once, and they asked him about it, and it was a conscious choice for him to write those words. And he said, "Well, I'm not sure. Mm-hmm. I'm really not sure. I'm not sure if I'm out or if I'm in, Anything else? Okay. Let's see. So this is as far as I got in my script. So before, this is the page I was going to write on the bus, or the bus had gotten me home, all right? So forgive me. I'm just going to try to wing it a little bit here, but we'll play that. Okay, and then go to these two. Next on the last side of the White Album, Honey Pie, Savoy Truffle, and, okay, let's do these two together. Next on side 4 of the White Album, Honey Pie, Savoy Truffle, and Cry Baby Cry. So there we have Cry Baby Cry, Savoy Truffle, and Honey Pie, McCartney, Harrison, and John Lennon. I will say before we end up playing those, I will tell these quick stories that the Savoy Truffle is The song lyric is made up of the exotic names in a box of chocolates called Good News that was popular in Britain. Cream tangerine, Montelet Mart, ginger sling, coffee dessert, cherry cream. They were just, you know, grabbing the names right out of the box. Anyway.
Wasn't it kind of written for Eric Clapton also?
I think that I remember hearing that that they were together when it was written, and that maybe Clapton had been having some teeth problems, had some teeth pulled, which was also referenced in the song. You know, you'll have to have your...
A lot of sweets because he was burrowing into his heroin addiction at the time also. That's kind of why it was written that way,
yeah.
As I understand it, but yeah.
Our sweet addictions.
Just further proof that they were thinking out of the box.
Gosh, I barely remember those songs. It's like, you know, you get to the bottom of the bag of chips and it's all crumbs down there. What's left here?
Well, people have a theory about that because of the next song, Revolution Number 9, which was this, you know, 8-minute sound collage that I remember being deathly frightened of as a 12-year-old.
I think I pretty much listened to it one time, the first time, and never bothered to listen to it again.
This really smacks to me of underground FM, especially the late night guys, my favorites. Because often through high school, I went to sleep with a AM/FM clock radio on my pillow with me so I wouldn't wake up my parents. And usually got to sleep anywhere from 1 to 2 in the morning. But usually something like this was sandwiched right in between the Mothers of Invention and, you know, Jimi Hendrix somewhere. And it was always fun. I enjoyed it because you always kind of looked for things, you know. And the emergence of Yoko on tape, I assume, and some of the female voices. And, you know, the Hold That Line and the sports references. And just the little things you kind of look forward to in 8 minutes of this cacophony, you know.
Yeah, Lou, do you even remember hearing that one?
No, I just remember that number nine. For some reason, I just remember that part. But now looking back, I guess I must have been influenced because when I do these programs with alternative music, I end up with these number nine spoken word rock.
Yeah. Suze?
Yeah, it reminds me of Yoko's influence on him. I think as an avant-garde artist, it helped him feel... probably more, I don't know, maybe he was braver or something to put together music that was like art. And that reminds me of how much little girls hated Yoko. God, that was just so maddening. It was hard enough to find out that he was married and then that he wanted to leave his wife for Yoko. Is like it just I didn't get it, you know. And as much as I respect the guy now and I actually really like Yoko, I remember at the time how just brutal little girls were about Yoko. We just hated her. It was so unfair to them.
Okay, so the cacophony of Revolution 9 is followed by this. So what do you think of that as an album capper for the White Album?
Yeah, the first is like, wake up. Let's get, you know, and then it ends that way. It's kind of like strange, but it's so pleasant, but it's kind of strange because the norm of the whole LP was like rock, you know, and obscured and on the edge.
And given all the things that we've said about John Lennon's contribution on this album, this is a John Lennon song written for his son Julian as a lullaby.
Mm-hmm. I was about to say it may have been the first lullaby for big babies.
It's like the end credits to an acid trip to me. It's like this whole journey you've been taking through four sides and in many dimensions and many different sounds, and here you're at the end and it's just this sweet thing, and you're heading for the exits.
It does have a cinematic quality to it, I agree.
Well, there's a quote in one of my books here. John Lennon gave it to George Martin to orchestrate and said, just make it Hollywood. I know it's schmaltzy. Go for it.
And they let Ringo sing it.
I liked that. I mean, I don't know if I really knew about the sort of sweetness that I associate with Ringo Starr then. I think I just sort of felt it. And then when he was given that vocal, it, I don't know. I still get a little sentimental hearing it. You know, obviously it pulls at the heartstrings because that's what those kind of Hollywood strings are meant to do, but it gets me. Suze, were you thinking of anything? I think I cut you off earlier.
Don't bogart the joint.
No.
All right, last call on any thoughts that might be I might slip in anywhere about experience.
I missed a couple of songs, but that's okay.
Which one?
Honey Pie and
Wild Honey Pie. You mean?
Yeah, and Honey Pie itself, we didn't really talk about.
Okay.
Well, Honey Pie, once again, here's Paul and Sunday afternoon tea. And smacks of Rudy Valley.
I was going to say, Rudy Valley, 1930s dance hall, kind of like singing into a tin can microphone.
Yeah.
The song my parents would like to listen to on the record.
I really like that effect when, you know, now she's hit the big time. You know, that was, I mean, fascinating to me at the time. What else did we miss, Scott?
What was the one after that? I'm sorry.
Savoy Truffle.
Oh, okay, that came after.
Yeah, we talked about that. Candy Box.
Okay, I'm sorry.
And Cry Baby Cry, which we didn't talk a lot about. And I skipped a couple just because I'm not going to be able to get all of them in. Is Bungalow Bill one of your favorites?
Mm. Well, it just reminds me of like something that would have had on Captain Kangaroo.
Okay, that's it. Thanks so much.
Thank you.
I appreciate it.
You guys.
It was fun.